gentlemen, very warm welcome to the Museum of History of Science tonight, our evening lecture. I'm Zilke Ackermann, I'm the director, and it's a particular pleasure to welcome you to an evening talk. I would like to flag up a couple of things you may or may not have seen. Our current exhibition on Harry Moseley, who is of course the reason why we are all here tonight. We have, as you may be aware, reached national radio with this exhibition already. It's touching people in many different ways. So if you haven't seen it, please do come back. I would also like to flag up that, as with so many other things, we can only do and keep up this work with your support. So if you would like to give a donation on your way out, we would be most grateful. Alternatively, you can also invest in our latest merchandise. As you know, of course, Harry Moseley was involved, one might say, with the periodic table. And here is the first ever purpose-made merchandise of the museum, which is, if you haven't spotted that, a handmade chocolate spelled out with the elements. You can have it in either milk or in dark. It's available from our museum shop upstairs. The presentation tonight is, of course, very special because you might ask, mostly in Manchester, he studied in Oxford. Why on earth would anybody want to leave Oxford to go to Manchester? Well, there is a good reason for it, and we're particularly pleased to welcome Dr. Neil Todd from Manchester, who said he's going to introduce himself to explain to us why Moseley did that. Neil, over to you.
Okay, thank you very much. Well, let me start by thanking the organisers of today's lecture for inviting me. It's very kind of you. I should say right at the start that I'm not a professional historian, and my interest in Moseley is quite accidental. Although I started out as a physicist, I actually switched fields as a postgraduate, and I did my PhD in psychology. And after a few postdoctoral jobs, I ended up at Manchester in the Department of Psychology as a lecturer teaching perception. I have a particular interest in hearing, that's my specialisation. And it so happened that the building in which I worked as a psychologist historically was occupied by Rutherford and the Department of Physics in the early 20th century. So I found myself as a lecturer in psychology, actually working in the old physics building. That's the very one that's on the advertisement for this lecture. And that was the building in which Moseley did his work when he was there. That was my connection to the building, but I should say my particular interest in the history of science and history of the building was sparked off by the discovery, or rather I should say the rediscovery, of radioactive contamination in that building, which dated from the early 20th century, from Rutherford's occupation. This stuff had been there 100 years. And when this stuff was discovered, or rather rediscovered, in the late 90s, a number of people were naturally anxious because they thought it might represent a health hazard. Although, of course, I, as an occupant, was also, you know, concerned that about the possibility of a health hazard, it struck me that actually this contamination was a most marvellous new form of archaeological information. You know, where did the stuff come from? Why was it here? What was it doing in these particular rooms? So I became quite intrigued and got very involved in finding out the research on that. And as my interest grew, I you know, became kind of a serious passion for history of science. So I got the history of science bug. And I've since published a couple of papers on radium, and I have a forthcoming book called Radioactive Ghosts. Now the aim of my talk today is to give an impression of what was going on in Manchester physics before, during, and immediately after Moseley. So I'm going to start with just telling you very briefly about Owens College, the precursor to the university. Then I'm going to say something about how the new physical laboratory, which was erected in 1900, that's the building which is shown on the advertisement for the lecture. Just to tell you a little bit about that building, how it was organised. Then I'm going to tell you about how Rutherford adapted the building and his impact on the science. And then at that point I will introduce Moseley and give a brief indication about Moseley's life inside and outside the laboratory. I briefly mention something which you wouldn't immediately think was that relevant, but there's a particular extension building in 1912 which is of interest. And then we get on to the most fundamental part of the talk in terms of the physics, which is that Moseley's interest in X-ray and his interaction with Niels Bohr. And finally, I'll just say a little bit about what happened after Moseley left. This is an architect's drawing of the Owens College, or New Owens College as it was known then, which was erected in 1873 on the same site as what is now the University of Manchester. You can get a little bit of information about what was going on from the campus map of 1890. So here is the original Owens building, and you can see that quite a big chunk of it is devoted to physics, also engineering. In addition, we have a medical school, a chemistry building, engineering, geology. There's also a museum, a natural history museum. But it's mostly surrounded by these old terraced houses. Now, some of the luminaries of the old Owens College that are particularly relevant to the history of physics include Arthur Schuster, Horace Lamb in mathematics, but also here are some other physicists who you probably weren't aware that they were associated with Manchester. There's one, Poynting, who is particularly involved in electromagnetism. A famous J.J. Thomson, the discoverer of the electron, was a Manchester man. Also Arthur Eddington, famous for the experiments to test Einstein's theory. He was also a Manchester man. So there was a lot of important people there. Towards the end of the 19th century, this is just a picture showing you the late 19th century ordnance survey map expanded out from the previous one. Here's the Owens College, mainly surrounded by all these terraced houses, but also this important tramway running through past the college. Towards the end of the 19th century, the old building became too small and it was necessary to design a new building. And this is an architect's drawing of the new physical laboratory as it was known then. Arthur Schuster was particularly important for the building. He was instrumental in persuading the university to agree to the establishment of the new building and in soliciting a large number of donations to finance it. Here is the architect's drawing from that time. This is the picture I think you've used in your advertisement. Okay. Now we can also see, again, we go to the Ordnance Survey map from 1908, we can see how the college has expanded. Okay, here is the old original building. So the medical school has expanded. And over here, this is the location of the new physics building. You can see the general shape of it. It has this sort of a quadrangle here. But it's also, again, surrounded by these terraced houses. There's also another building here as well. We have some pictures from the time. This is one of the new buildings from 1900. This is the Whitworth building from Oxford Street. Here you can see this very important tramway running past the front of the university. It's a major artery through Manchester at the time. Here is a picture of the medical school running up, this is called Coupland Street, which is a street onto which the physics building was erected. So here again is here's the picture of the Physic Building, and this is actually a pamphlet taken from the opening ceremony of the mark the opening of the building. To give you an indication of the importance, it was opened by no less than Lord Rayleigh at a conversazione, which is basically a public meeting, and a series of exhibitions. And here you can see some of the exhibitions that were put on throughout the whole of the new building. So it would have been quite a spectacular display of physical instrumentation. The importance of the building was also illustrated by the fact that there were a number of honorary fellows awarded, including J.J. Thompson, and a series of lectures. There's no doubt that the new Physical Institute was one of the most modern and advanced in the world at the time. Now, we know quite a lot about how it was organised, because Arthur Schuster was particularly good at recording things, and we have these very detailed plans of the building. So this is a ground floor plan of the building. Here's the front part of the building, with the main entrance that you can see in the architect's drawing. And you can see, first of all, here's a large private professor's laboratory, and a series of rooms which are essentially devoted to electromagnetism. And the reason for that is that the institution wasn't just physics, it was physics and electrotechnics. So you can see that attached to the main part of the building was the John Hopkinson's Memorial Wing, which housed a very large dynamo house, which supplied electricity throughout the whole building, an electrochemical laboratory, and all sorts of other electrical important structures for electricity, including a huge accumulator room and a switchboard room, which could be used to direct power throughout the building. We actually have a few pictures of that. Here is a picture of the dynamo hall. You see these. This is on the first floor. Underneath was a gas generator, which powered these machines. And you can see these various. Not so clear on this one, but you can see that it's, when this was all powered up, you can imagine it made a big noise. It was quite a hum going on. Here's actually another view of the same generator room. I think you can see these wires running along here, which is what that just shows a way in which the electricity was transmitted throughout the building. This is the adjacent electrochemical laboratory. Again, you can see the power supply coming through here. This is the switchboard room that I pointed out on the map. Again, quite a sophisticated piece of machinery designed to select particular currents for a particular rooms or devices. Okay, here's a picture of the first floor. And again, I should point out here is a private professor's room. This was successively occupied by all the four future professors. And this, you can see, is largely devoted to the teaching of elementary physics, including this large elementary physical laboratory here. And I think we have a picture of that. So this is a picture of the elementary physics laboratory. This would have been very familiar to Henry Moseley, when he first arrived in Manchester in 1910. He would have been working as a demonstrator in this room. So then we go on to the second floor. Here we see this featured a magnificent large lecture theatre and a series of other rooms involved in preparation for the lecture theatre. Also, we see some other rooms that were, here there's a transit room, that's an astronomical transit room, and here a grating room, and this is devoted to spectroscopy, which is one of the particular interests of Arthur Schuster. Here is actually a picture of the old lecture theatre. Now, this was stayed pretty much unchanged for nearly one century, and when I first started working at at the university. I gave lectures in this theatre. So I can say without any shadow of a doubt, I was the last physicist to give a lecture in that room, before it was sadly destroyed, tragically destroyed, some years after that. There are actually a few pictures I've managed to glean of Arthur Schuster in on this top floor. Here is Schuster giving a lecture in the large theatre. Here he's got a discharge tube demonstrating electrical discharge. Here is a picture of Arthur Schuster in the transit room with a transit instrument. This instrument still survives and is in the new physics building on the display on the first floor. Here is an example of a Roland grating, which was used for spectroscopic research. Here's another instrument that was used at the time, a heliostat, which could direct the sunlight into the grating room. So that this very much illustrates how Arthur Schuster designed the building. And last but not least, I should mention the basement. Here's the generator I mentioned that powered the building. But also in the basement were a large of these research rooms. So the basement was really where most of the research took place. Okay? And as we'll see later on, Moseley later occupied one of these rooms, in particular this room here, which then later became known as the Moseley Room. Here's a nice photograph taken from 1903 from inside the dynamo hall. This is a picture. It includes Frederick Soddy, the chemist Frederick Soddy, and a number of other luminaries of 19th century science, including Boltzmann, and I think that's Millikan. And it just so happened they congregated in Manchester for a British Association meeting in Southport. That was quite a famous meeting. Everyone's got their own favourite British Association meeting. Mine is 1903, because that's where radium was first discussed as the concept of atomic energy was first discussed. In 1903, radium suddenly became, took off. Although it was discovered in 1898, it was in 1903 that there was huge demand for it. And Frederick Soddy himself had contributed to that by that year he had, with William Ramsay, had demonstrated that helium was generated from radium. And he no doubt conveyed his enthusiasm to Arthur Schuster, who was standing next to him. And Arthur Schuster was determined that he should also have some radium, like everybody else, that Manchester could not be without the stuff. And here we actually have a receipt from 1903 to Arthur Schuster from the chemist and homeopathist Armbrex and Nelson of London, recording the dispatch and receipt of 20 milligrams of radium bromide at 30 shillings. About £30. I actually have a contemporary advertisement from Armbrex and Nelson advertising radium for sale. So literally you could, at that time you could actually go into the shop and buy some. You could also buy other interesting things as well, like for example a newly invented thorium inhaler, which you could use your asthma wish. Interestingly, Armbrex and Nelson still exists today in the same place. It's a homeopathist, so it hasn't moved in 100 years. This is a picture actually of Rutherford, who at that time was in Montreal. He was the McGill professor at McGill University. This is a picture of Rutherford in his basement laboratory. I'm showing this because what it illustrates is the way in which radium was kept at the time. Although it was isolated as a salt, because it's such a tiny amount of it, it was incredibly powerful stuff. One had to be very careful that either you just lose it and you can contaminate things very easily. So it was actually put into solution, attached to a mercury pump, and the radioactive gas, then called radium emanation, which we now know as radon, could be milked off over mercury, and then you could use that for experiments. Here's a picture of the apparatus. Here's the radium dissolved in a bulb, surrounded by a bit of lead to stop the radiation damage. Actually, there was a connection between Soddy and Rutherford, because Soddy had just been working with Rutherford. They had then just announced the theory of successive changes to explain radioactivity. And when Soddy had discovered radium being sold in shops in 1903, he alerted Rutherford. And of course, Rutherford also wanted some as well. And so actually this kit was sent over from London by Soddy, as well as the radium. Here's another, here's my last picture from the Schuster period. This is a picture of engineering physics, 1906, in the quadrangle. Here is Arthur Schuster, along with other senior people in the university. And what I've done here is ringed some of the young men in the department who then went on to work with Rutherford, and also Moseley. Here we have Walter Macauer, Sidney Russ, Thomas Royce, and there's one over there who I can't remember, I'm sorry about that. That was the department at the end of 1906. By which time, Schuster wanted to retire, and he was looking for a successor, and he was able to persuade Rutherford to take over his position. So when Rutherford arrived in Manchester in 1907, he was already very famous. He conducted the work for which he was awarded the Nobel Prize in 1908. And much of that work he did with Soddy, that was elaborating the theory of successive transformations to explain radioactivity. He was already very famous when he arrived. Although he did have some radium in Montreal, he didn't bring that with him. So in order to do his research, he needed to get some radium. So it was a clear priority for Rutherford at that time. And then here we have Rutherford's notes from 1908, recording the arrival, received Saturday, February the 14th, radium weight 3.95 grams of radium barium chloride in quartz tube with stopper. And then this shows how he calibrated the radium. He actually had a small radium bromide standard, and then he put the new sample into an electroscope. This is called an emanation electroscope, because it was used the activity of the radioactive gas coming off it to calibrate how strong the source was. And then he compared that with his standard, and he worked out how much he had. There's actually a lot of confusion in the literature, in the Rutherford literature, but here it is actually in Rutherford's own writing. He worked out that he had the equivalent of about 450 milligrams of radium bromide, about half a gram, which, in terms of pure radium, it works out the amount of elemental radium of about a quarter of a gram, which is about a quarter of a gram. What's a quarter of a gram? You might think that's a tiny amount of stuff. Actually, it was a huge amount of things, because radium was so powerful. And it was with this radium that all the successive discoveries, including all Moseley's work, it was all done with this stuff. But of course, you had to be very careful how you handled it. And one of the most important things that Rutherford did when he first arrived was to reorganise the laboratory. And a very important thing to do was to find a room in which to put the radium. And Schuster's transit room became the radium room. So all the glass apparatus I showed you in that previous picture, that was all set up in there, and the pumps and everything like that. Another reason for putting it at the top of the building was that Rutherford, like everybody else, made all the same mistakes when he first got some radium, because they tended to work in the basement. But of course, as soon as you take the stopper off the container of radium, already you're contaminating everything, because the gas just move out of the jar and spread itself through diffusion around buildings. Everything gets contaminated. And it renders the laboratory absolutely useless. So it then became standard practice to have the radium room at the top of the building, so that if any radium emanation escaped, you'd open the windows and let the gas out. And this had the convenience of having these two big windows. So the gas would tend to go up rather than down. William Lansbury was a technician who worked in that room. Another famous character from Rutherford's time was William Kay, who worked at the other end of the building in the preparation room. Very famous experiment was done in that radium room, not least the Rutherford and Roy's 1908 experiment, which showed that the alpha particle is indeed a helium nucleus, and that was a very important experiment. Some of that apparatus still exists to a certain extent. This is actually in the Cavendish Museum. But one of the things I worked out that is there's a disparity between this and the picture that goes with it. And I worked out that it probably would have looked a bit more like this, but that's another story. I just wanted to point out that was an important experiment that took place up there. Now, you all have seen this picture before. This is the famous picture of Rutherford and Geiger in the basement. This is this room here, is what the old liquid air room. Okay, so I found out where that room was. I rediscovered where that was. Although the radium was at the top of the building, all the research was done in the basement. They're clearly all Geiger's work. For example, the famous work on alpha scattering, which led to the discovery of the nucleus, that was all done in that basement. Another quality about this room is, the basement is, it had a photographic room, which was ideal for producing a dark room for doing scintillation counting. This was because in those days one did counting by eye. You had to look at a screen and literally count the number of flashes. So that was all done in this room here. And this is again some of the early forms of Geiger counter that were developed in that basement. I don't expect you to follow the details. I'm just sort of giving you an impression of some of the stuff that was done there. So here was a picture of the group from 1909. It was shortly after those experiments were done, and here we can see Rutherford, of course, and here is some other Makoa who we saw previously. Here it is Hans Geiger, and it's Marsden. Here's William Lansbury, the technician. Here's William Cave, the technician. So these are some of the characters that became part of the central part of Rutherford's laboratory before Moseley arrived. This is one of my favourite pictures, actually. I love this one. This is outside the chemical shed in 1910. Because obviously, as I mentioned, one of the problems with working with radium and radioactive substances in general is it's dirty. Things get contaminated. And even though they are putting in a lot of precautions in the main building, things still got contaminated. So the really dirty radiochemistry was done in a shed outside. So here we have this Hans Geiger. Here are the two technicians, backbone of the laboratory. Here is another famous chemist. I forgot his name for a second. He visited the laboratory in 1910 for a year to work with Rutherford. The name will come back to me later on. He was a friend of Rutherford's from working in Canada. But they together had worked on dating radioactive rocks. I can't remember the name. This is the moment. Okay, so here we have, we're now up to 1910 and Moseley's time in Manchester. When we know a lot about the Manchester period from Moseley's letters, and using his letters and a bit of local geography, we can work out quite a lot about what was going on there. This is an audience survey map from 1894 showing the layout of Manchester and South Manchester where Moseley lived. Here is the Owens College. You can just make out the sort of quadrangle there. And then we've got this main artery here through down which the trams ran. That was Oxford Road, which turned into Wilmslow Road. And this ran south of Manchester through a series of suburbs called Rusholme, Fallowfield, Withington, to the centre of Withington, which is where Moseley's lodgings were when he first arrived. And that was pretty close to where Rutherford's house was. So he made his journey every day to and from the laboratory. I can read out a couple of his extracts from some of his letters. So September, October 1910, I get into Dunwood House on Thursday, which will be excellent as these lodgings are far from comfortable. And he already mentions that Rutherford has been extremely kind in asking me several times to the house for a long motor ride one day. Because another thing you can notice from this is that though the centre of Manchester is, of course, extremely dense, full of these terrace houses, you don't have to go very far to really get into the countryside. It really is quite rural around here. So Rutherford could drive out from his house into the countryside. And it was quite common he would take new students out with him, and Moseley had that pleasure as well. He tells us a little bit about people he lived with. My companions here are a well-meaning psychologist, a nice but boring pedagogic economist, and an interesting but probably very nice literature. The house is run by clockwork, and the housekeeper is averse to deviations. The seven-day rotational food supply is good but very stodgy. The most troublesome feature is the distance from the college, half an hour walk, 15 or 20 minutes by tram, as the road has always been up, resulting in delay. It's a very good half-hour walk. You'd have to be very briskly to do that half-hour. He also mentions something about the climate as well, which, of course, Manchester was famous for its smog. So he says, the climate here is unusual, but not so bad as it's pictured. The last 10 days have been two brown fogs, one white, one bright frosty day, one snow, five rain, but never a long day, never all day. And what I've done is, this is for another talk I did, I've reconstructed a sequence of images from old photographs and postcards to reconstruct the journey that Moseley would have taken on the tram going from college to his lodging. So I'm going to go through this quite quickly, just to give you an impression. But here we go. So here is the tramway running. The college was just up here. This is looking north on Wilmslow Road. And here's the tramway. There's a theatre here on the left. Here's a little bit further into Rusholme, looking north. Here's a local pub called Clarence Inn. You can see it's quite a lot of shops along here, so it was then quite a well-to-do place, quite unlike the Curry Mile that there is today. So it's quite a posh area. Here, again, is a little bit going further south into Rusholme, a very important landmark at the time, the Congregational Church, the architect of which was Alfred Waterhouse, who lived close by. So he lived around that area at the time. This is a little bit further down. You can see the church in the background there. This is going past Platt Lane into what was then known as the Rusholme Boulevard. So it was a very pleasant sort of leafy area, which, as I indicated in the previous map, was not far from the countryside, and some of the side roads literally were country roads. Here is a little bit further down, getting towards the next suburb, Fallowfield. Here's some farm carts going up and down here, so it really was like being in the countryside. This one I love. This is illustrating the smog, one of the smogs from that time. Moses says, yeah, today the fog is so thick I should get lost on the way to college. It tastes acrid and tickles the throat. Yesterday the tram in which I came back lost itself badly. and I finally got out somewhere and groped for a side street on which to find a street name, which luckily I recognised. Monday the fog was thinner, but more yellow. That's kind of a yellow effect there, isn't it? And this is again coming into Fallowfield, and going to Fallowfield. View from Fallowfield Station, and then again Fallowfield Station a bit further on. And this is looking south now from Fallowfield, and Rutherford's house was literally just around the corner here. Okay, so it's possible that Mrs. Rutherford did some shopping here for her groceries. I did that very quickly just to give you an impression. As I mentioned, Rutherford's house is quite close by. This is a blown-up picture of Withington. This is Rutherford's house. This is a picture of Rutherford outside his house with his car, which he paid for with his 1908 Nobel Prize money. And this is the car in which Mosley would have gone driving to the countryside with Rutherford. So Mosley, he would have walked past that or taken the tram past that every day on the way to college. Now, there's something very interesting also about that house, which takes us back to the science in Manchester at the time, which is that although people associate the discovery of the atomic nucleus with the Manchester and the laboratory, actually the discovery didn't take place in the laboratory, it took place in Rutherford's house, because he tended to work in his study, first of all study at home. And famously, there was this night which later became dubbed a Sunday night that changed physics. Rutherford had one of his famous dinners where he invited people around for dinner, including Charles Darwin, where he announced his results of his scattering, the scattering law, the scattering experiments to come up with his scattering law. So you can imagine that the young Mosley, when he first arrived in Manchester, this amazing discovery was taking place. But of course, at the time, the significance of it was not known. It wasn't really appreciated. Again, here, for those of you not familiar with Rutherford's scattering law, this is Rutherford's own notes. I don't expect you to follow that, but this is just showing the geometry of the scattering law. This is a concentrated, massive central nucleus. This shows the geometry of a particle, the same charge, being scattered away from that centre. Okay, so that is revolutionary, because previous to that, we'd had the so-called plum pudding model, which said that the mass was evenly distributed throughout the atom. Now, at the time when this was going on, Mosley was not; he was working on something completely different. As a research student, he was given some fairly humdrum radioactivity research, which he complained about at the time, because he was nevertheless already a very highly competent scientist, and one of the things he was working on was the number of beta particles emitted in the transformation of radium, which was later published in the Proceedings of the Royal Society. This was done in the basement, in this room here, as I mentioned. This was opposite the room from where the Rutherford guide were taken. This is the room here, the Mosley room. And it's very interesting to read this. He's talking about how difficult the work was, creating a vacuum, and the delicacy of the experiment. He starts the experiment with a glass tube of thickness much less than tissue paper, filled with radium emanation. On this occasion, it chose to break off its stalk inside, and everything had to come to pieces to get it out. Fishing for a thing which breaks out of touch was too risky to be tried, for to let emanation loose upon the laboratory was a capital offence. Because even though they had the dirty work outside, that they, if one of these little tubes broke, the regular emanation diffused throughout the whole building, and all the experiments couldn't be done for a day. It ruined the laboratory. So these very strict laws were given by Rutherford to avoid it. And this is one of my favourites, because it really illustrates how science was done. Again, see, he's now working in a basement. I'm writing in a laboratory so steam-heated that even with coat off, it's hardly bearable. You see, he's actually quite close to the boiler house, so it's not really surprising. At present, beta experiments must be got through while my supply of emanation lasts. The experiment is now clamoring for attention, and I must go to it. So he's literally writing the letter in this basement here. And so I must go to it. I have many things in a minimum of time, many things to do in a minimum of time, that it seems more like a conjuring trick than anything else. The experiment begins in the attic, he means on the second floor, and continues in my room on the ground floor, he means the lower ground floor, so that I have to race down three flights of stairs in the middle, to the great astonishment of the occasional student. Now just think about that, you've got this, you've been upstairs in the radio room, you prepare this delicate little tube full of this highly radioactive substance, and then you run down three flights of stairs, okay, get into the basement, and put this thing into your apparatus. You know, it just seems extraordinary, but that's how it was done. And that's one of the things we can learn from Moseley's letters. Okay, around about the time Moseley moved house, one of the things I tried to do is find out where all his Moseley houses were. He moved to what was then called the High Street, and this is 159 to 81 High Street. This is a photograph of 159, it's no longer there, next to this hotel here, but that's where it was. So he lived at this spot for a short while. Okay, so my next thing I was going to talk about was the 1912 extension. Now you think, well, why the 1912 extension? It seems a bit odd, but the building is some quite significance, because in 1912 it was a major thing which took place at the laboratory. Because by this time Rutherford attracted so many students that the place was packed out. It wasn't enough room for the students. So then there was a desperate need for more space. So this was the opening, this was the part of the new building. You can see it's right next to the old quadrangle there. That's the main 900 building. And this was also, it was open to great fanfare with a conversazione and a public exhibition. Again, it was a spectacular exhibition of stuff. It included Hans Geiger in working in the basement with an exhibition called Counting Atoms. So I just find that remarkable. And it had all sorts of demonstrators of radioactivity and so on. And Moseley would have been heavily involved in probably giving demonstrations and helping out with that. So it was a great event, opening the new laboratory. This shows you the top floor, planned top floor, with these six rooms here, labelled A to F. Now, these reveal another very interesting thing about the building and what was going on at the time, which was that, I read, this is from Schuster's description of it, the physics research rooms marked A to F in plans are situated on the first floor of the north wing, in a position they are well outside the range of penetrating radiations from active material in the main building, which is some 30 yards further south. What he's saying there is that the original building had become so radioactively contaminated, despite all the precautions, you know, accidents happen. You only just one little drop of radium solution and you've got permanent contamination. You just need to get a bit on your hands, everything you touch becomes contaminated. So then, in addition to space for students, they also needed space to have contamination-free research rooms. If you were trying to do some delicate photographic work, you had to. So Rutherford also describes this. A part of the new extension was set aside for the use of the physics department. The rooms so provided have already proved of great service in research work. The new laboratory has the great advantage of being free from all radioactive contamination, and has thus been possible to carry out refined experiments which would have been very difficult in the main laboratory. That's, of course, the stuff was still there 100 years later. You know. Okay, so I'm going to move on. Now, of course, another very important thing happened in 1912, literally weeks after the building was open, was the arrival of one Niels Bohr, who made his first visit to Manchester. He stayed in the rather grand Hume Hall. This is a picture of Hume Hall. And I like to think, in the same way that Rutherford's house could be thought of as the birthplace of the nucleus, this could be thought of as the birthplace of the quantum atom, because it was during here that Bohr first the idea of putting Planck's constant into the atom. And here is what's then subsequently be called the Paul Rutherford Memorandum of July 1912, where he first puts forward this special hypothesis of using Planck's constant to relate energy to the frequency or wavelength. So this is the first germ of the Bohr's quantum atom came out of that building. And his short visit in spring of 1912. At that time, he didn't interact with Moseley very much, even though he lived quite close to Moseley. Hume Hall was literally around the corner from where Moseley was then living. this is a picture of the 1912 physics group, which was taken at the entrance to the 1912 extension. So here is the young Moseley sitting in the front row here, sitting in front of Walter Macauer, Hans Geiger, was Rutherford, of course, James Chadwick, Charles Darwin, other famous characters from that time. Now, already by this time, Moseley had published three papers on his early work on radioactivity. Already he'd established himself as a scientist. He was also doing work on a radium battery, which he then went on to publish the following year. So already he'd established himself as a scientist. I don't expect you to follow the details of that. I just wanted to give you the impression that Moseley had already... Well, the time of that photograph was already a published scientist. And then we get on to 1913, and then some momentous things take place. One was in April of 1912, the announcement of X-ray diffraction by Max von Laue. This is the famous von Laue X-ray diffraction photograph. And it was this sparked huge interest around the world, not least in Rutherford's laboratory. Even though X-ray was not Rutherford's thing, Rutherford was a radioactivity man, Moseley managed to persuade Rutherford to allow him to work on this, which he did with Charles Darwin. And they worked on this paper, which they published, the reflection of X-rays using crystals. That was an important thing which happened during that year. This is the 1913 physics photograph taken back in front of the old 1900 building. Here's Moseley sitting next to Darwin. It's probably just a coincidence they're sitting together, but there's a mismatch between the screen here. So they were working together there. I've got a problem here, which is the technical problem. Sorry, there's a mismatch between what's happening here and what's happening up there. Sorry about that. Do you know this machine? I'm sorry about that. It's not scrolling forward. Can you jump out of it and jump back in?
You can hang on a second. We'll just go back to do that.
Okay. as far forward. Yes, okay, yeah, right. So, many apologies for that. We've lost the range there. I'll carry on. It's jumped out of range. Okay. So Niels Bohr, the arrival of Niels Bohr, he, in his trilogy of papers, put forward this theory of the quantum atom, which beautifully explained the hydrogen spectrum. And it was around this time that, unlike 1912, there was a strong interaction between Bohr and Moseley, which was captured in an interview which took place in 1962 with Niels Bohr. He said, yes, but all this came up later, you see, because actually it was me who brought it up to Moseley and Darwin. They wanted to speak to me, you see, and then I explained to them what my view was on the periodic table. I had, of course, thought about it before, and we talked to Rutherford. And then, as far as I remember, Moses said, "All right, we shall see." There's a famous saying that they worked out that there must be this relationship. You know, if the elements were organized according to atomic number, according to the Bohr theory, there should be this very systematic relationship between the X-ray spectra and atomic number. So Moses said, "Okay, we shall see." And then, he did the experiments in a very, very short time. So within months, he had done this experiment, and he came up with his early first results, this famous picture here, which is called Moseley's Ladder, which shows the systematic relationship between the X-ray lines and the atomic number. Okay. Here is a picture from 1914, physics. Charles Darwin is still there, but Moseley has, of course, moved back to Oxford. But it's also, you see that the department is now becoming a little depleted because the war is already starting. Then we move on to 1914, Moseley in Oxford. And of course, this is the next paper we published, the high frequency spectra of the elements, part two. The apparatus of which still exists and is here in this very laboratory on exhibition. One thing I will note about this is that even though this was made in Oxford, some of it was still made in Manchester. Not least this the vacuum chamber. You can't read it here, but it says made by Chas Cook of Manchester. Okay, so it was even one of the things he was particularly frustrated about was it's so slow in Oxford to get things done. So he still had to go back to Manchester to get things made. Again, here is this famous picture, which also is on display around the corner. So I don't need to tell you any more about that. And of course, John Heilbronn, who will be speaking later in the year, will go into the details of this. I think I'm probably coming to the concluding part of the talk. I went through that quite quickly because I'm aware that there is another speaker who is particularly going to talk about the science. Professor John Heilbronn. So I don't want to repeat what he's going to be saying. And really what I was trying to do was give you an impression of all the things that were going on. It's very difficult to do that, partly because there was so much going on. It was an extraordinary period in the history of science. If you think we'd gone from, just a few years before, we had the old periodic table, old Newtonian concept of mechanics. Within really 5-10 years, the whole of physics, modern science had been completely transformed. Modern science had emerged. But sadly, during that period, it was interrupted by the debacle of the Great War, and because the signs were already there long before 1914. Is a picture of Hans Geiger on military exercises in 1910. So even though he was working in the laboratory, he was would often go back to Germany to engage in his military exercises. And of course, most of the young men in the laboratory also went off to war, including, of course, Moseley. So that Rutherford was, from 1914 onwards, the laboratory was almost depleted, apart from one or two individuals, including Niels Bohr, who actually came back to Manchester and was employed as a reader in mathematical physics. Despite Rutherford being pretty much working on his own, he did continue some work, along with the war work, and that included work on work which led to the publication in 1919 of the famous quartet of papers, which announced the splitting of the atom, nuclear transmutation. And that was all done in this room here, which was the old professor's private laboratory on the ground floor. That was rather commandeered, that as his own private laboratory. So a lot of his work went on in that room. Here is just some of the pieces of apparatus that were there. The bench still exists. This is actually the room as it is today. It's been transformed into what's now called the Rutherford Room. This is the original bench. That's the bench as it was in the late 1990s when I was working in the building and the radioactivity was rediscovered. And this is just showing you how active it was. This is a sort of Geiger count, a scan over the top of the bench. Here, like off the scale. So. But there were a number, although you know, physics had moved out of the building in 1968, the physicists there had marked some of the important points where experiments were done. And there was a plaque at the time which marked on the bench, just say on this bench, on the bench below, the artificial disintegration of nitrogen was first achieved by Rutherford. Okay, and there are a number of other these plaques around the place. One of the things I did, one of the tasks I set myself was to rediscover where all these key points were. And turn out there some plaques which we thought were missing are still there at the moment. One of the things I've tried to do is to, what I'm trying to get done is to put, re-erect the plaques in the original locations with more modern descriptions of what was going on. And among the plaques that were there, it was this one, which is from 1913, or commemorating 1913. So in this room, Moseley first measured the K and L series of X-rays photographically, and so established the law of atomic number. There is also one here marking the electrical method of atomic counting by Geiger and Rutherford. So, as I said, it was remarkable in that laboratory at the time. Sadly, broken up by the First World War, tragically. Who knows what could have been further achieved. But I cannot say any better than Ernest Rutherford himself, who, on returning to the university in the 1930s to open a new building, said, "I owe a great debt to Manchester for the opportunities it gave me to carry out my studies. I do not know whether the university is really aware that during the few years from 1911 onwards, the whole foundation of the modern physical movement came from the physical department of the Manchester University." I think at that point I've probably used up my time. I will stop. And